Welcome, guys. Max of the Accidental Engineer here. Today, we're joined by Ryan Bombach. For those of you guys who don't know who he is, Ryan is a senior iOS engineer who's worked on many different popular iOS apps in the comic book space, in the car insurance space with Metromile, and before that with IBM. Is that right?
HP.
My bad. So, Ryan, do you mind giving us kind of like a very general overview of how you came to be an iOS engineer from maybe like college or,
So, went to college, learned classic development, as they like to call it, which is interesting because I feel like if you haven't started in the JS world or in the web world, you're classically trained or whatever. So, classically trained, I guess, in college, but it was what's interesting is I went to school primarily to be a hardware engineer, and then you know once the .com bust happened, it was hard to get jobs in that space.
So just to date things, when was the .com bust?
2002,
2002,
somewhere around that area.
So there's probably two big job market dips: 2002, 2008, 2009. Which was worse?
Definitely 2002. It was impossible to get a job. I was applying to hundreds of places and getting maybe one phone call, only to say that you have no experience.
So your experience has been mirrors a lot of the people we've interviewed so far, in that you did computer engineering as opposed to computer science, and like many of us, your first job out of college was not actually computer engineering. So do you mind sharing about how you found your way to being a senior iOS engineer?
Sure. So, you know, not to be, you know, like everyone else, I guess you could say, that just had to figure out something to do to pay the bills. But I did something that was, you know, relatively easy, I guess you could say. I got into IT work initially at a school, paid the bills, gave me some time to figure out, okay, well, what can I do now? And I've always enjoyed, you know, software programming from the moment I pretty much got a computer and later in high school, and just kind of hung out with other nerds that were kind of doing cool stuff with it. But, you know, in the IT world, you know, it wasn't very challenging for me. You know, I troubleshooted stuff. I did the classic, you know, can you turn it off and turn it back on line.
So the distinction here is that in IT and infrastructure tech, You're helping people with their laptop problems or setting up their emails and that sort of thing. And that actually, I mean, I know many people who made that natural transition from being on IT call support or help desk support to finding a way onto either a testing team where they test the software or into software development where you're writing code. So what were the series of roles that you frog leaped into getting into iOS development and where you're at?
Okay, so, you know, in the IT world, you know, I just did that. You know, and then I was there maybe about a year and a half, and then once I started kind of noticing some jobs start to come up, I applied for a job as just a software test engineer at this company called Symmetricom. And I did some software testing. Well, not software testing, it was more hardware testing. When I had an internship at Cisco Systems when I was actually in college. So I kind of leveraged the, hey, I've tested things before. You know, I kind of know like a basic idea of things. And even though obviously there's different things that you do in hardware versus software, I figured, well, you know, at least I have kind of like a general idea of that. So I was able to kind of just use that to kind of build up my cover letter resume to say like, hey, let me do this. And then so I did that, and then pretty much did software testing for a few years. And then when I was kind of doing that, you know, on the side, I was just kind of learning how to do software development because I knew that's where I needed to go at that point.
For those who don't know, and myself included, what does the day-to-day look like in the role that you're in doing the software testing?
For software testing? Yeah. Primarily, it was just executing, like, test plans, you know, test cases based on whatever test plans you created. And I will say in the roles that I had, they were very waterfall. So, you know, you spent X amount of time up front to say, like, here's a plan, here's features that are coming out, or here's a product that we're releasing, and, you know, just basing previous experience on other plans or other projects and saying, well, you know, we did this for this, so here's what we know about the product that's coming out. Is it a system that is completely built from scratch? Is it something that's being pulled from something else and being modified? And so primarily once that was done, you just generated, you know, hundreds or even thousands of test cases that you need to be executed. And then you just pretty much spend most of your day just executing them. And then, you know, as you come across defects, you know, you log something in like, sure, a bug tracker to say like, hey, you know, this is what I expected to happen, this is what actually happened. And then just kind of building that communication between developers and explaining, in which can be challenging based on certain personality types, I guess you can say.
Oh, for, yeah, sure. Does that role of manual software tester still exist today? Is that a path that maybe a recent college grad can still get their foot in the door for people who didn't get their undergraduate bachelor's degree in computer science? Is that still a route available to
them? It's hard to say because I'm quite a lot of years off at that point. But I know that there are jobs in that, I guess you could say, in that field, but I don't know at what length they're decreasing just based on, you know, all the tools that are available now that weren't available 10 years ago. So it's hard to say whether or not it's more competitive because you have a bigger pool of people that maybe only have those skills.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I mean, maybe.
Well, now you work in a very specific area of software engineering, mm-hmm, which is software that runs on iOS devices, mm-hmm, whether that's iPhones or iPads. And in your current role, do you collaborate with any coworkers or contractors or third-party services that do manual testing for you? Or are you responsible for verifying and testing that your software works like it's supposed to work?
Right now, both.
Okay.
So usually I do a first pass of, you know, once the feature's done or once, you know, a bug gets logged, you know, just kind of doing the basics and figuring out, you know, did I do the job that I'm expected to do? And then once that's done, you know, that's logged in a tracking system somewhere. Usually I put in my notes to say, hey, this is the fix that was done, this is what I did to verify it, and, you know, give that to QA and say, hey, you know, what do you think? Do you accept this or do you reject this? And then, you know, if it's accepted, then it goes in the next build. If it's rejected, obviously, back to the drawing board, or maybe there's some scenario or something I didn't think of.
So one of the other peculiarities about the specific type of software you're writing for iOS is that there's the app approval process. Mm-hmm. So for the audience that isn't aware of just how radically different writing iOS software is, do you mind sharing what the app approval process means? Yeah.
Okay, so most people understand that iOS works within their own Apple's own ecosystem or sandbox. So pretty much what that means is if you want to have an app or an application that, you know, you could freely give out or sell that goes on other people's phones, you could only, and I say only because obviously there's other ways that you can distribute software, but pretty much the only way that you can get it on somebody else's device is you have to go through Apple's approval process. And so what that means is you build your app, you know, let's say that you're building a weather app, right? So you build your weather app, you do all the stuff that you need to do, and then you're like, okay, I'm done. Or you want to be able to give it to somebody so that they could test it. What you pretty much have to do is you have to upload this build to Apple, and then they do like a combination of behind the scenes, I guess you could say, acceptance tests on their end to verify whether or not you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing.
So to help bring this concrete, is there like a warehouse that Apple has somewhere where they employ people to just download your app that you want in the App Store and just click around? Is that seriously what happens?
That's a very good question.
It's in the cloud somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
So you can imagine, I guess, maybe Oompa Loompas or something, you know?
Sure. Has this manual approval process that's in place ever saved your ass from having software make it into the hands of customers that doesn't work?
At this point, no.
Okay. So you're just good.
Yeah. And
then, do you have any stories of other people that might have?
Honestly, no. Pretty much all I hear about from everyone about the approval process is it's just super aggressive about things that are inconsistent. So an example of a rejection I received in the past is a lot of times with authenticating or doing OAuth with services inside your app. A lot of apps, you know, bounce to Mobile Safari on the phone to authenticate and then bounce back in the app.
So this is like if you have a Facebook login in your app rather than requiring them to create a new account for your service.
And so there was a time where, you know, pretty much did the standard, you know, go to Safari to authenticate, get a token, all that kind of stuff, and got rejected for going outside the app to do this. But I could literally at that time name like hundreds of apps that did that. And so, and the thing is, sure, you know, what we ended up doing was doing something inside the app that actually did it for us. It did look cleaner at the end of the day, so it's not like there was any hard feelings there, but again, it's just a lot of people kind of get a little aggravated with this idea of inconsistency, because if it really is this data warehouse of people that are manually testing apps, obviously everyone has their own bias and their own ideas about the way things should work.
Sure. So how can you communicate with that black box that Apple has, where they are the judge of whether your software is allowed to show up on iPhones or not?
Yeah, so what happens if you get an app rejected is usually get an email that says there is a problem with one of your apps. You go in there and you just look, and there's usually a very cryptic answer saying what you've pretty much what you did wrong, I guess you can say. And then you either just do what they say and fix it, or there's a little text box and then you pretty much plead your case and then hit send, and then you wait however many days it takes for them to get back to you. And so, then you keep your fingers crossed.
Sounds like a lot of finger crossing. for people who've never written an app for iOS before, what's the minimum requirements you'll need in hand to make one? Like if I were making a website, I would just need to have a text editor to write HTML, CSS, and I would have to have a browser to open my web page and see that it looks right. What are the minimum requirements for someone who's never developed iOS before to get up and running? If not getting their app in the app store, maybe just having one on their phone to play with, having their own developed app to play with.
So if you actually want to build an iOS app, you're going to need a Mac.
Okay.
So whether that's, you know, a MacBook Pro
or iMac,
something that just runs OS X and allows you to download Xcode.
So your Dell, your whatever, your PC, it won't suffice. It won't work for developing iOS apps because Apple doesn't want you to. What's the reason, I guess?
So there's the SDKs that you need pretty much to do anything. Like if you were to even draw like layouts,
these are libraries that are used to their utilities for making the iOS app. Okay.
Yeah, and then you also have to use pretty much what's called Xcode build, which is the command line tool that actually builds the application. And you don't need Xcode to actually do that. There's command line tools, but again, you have to have a Mac to be able to run those.
So Xcode is just not available on Windows?
No.
Or on Linux? No. Or Ubuntu? Yeah,
got it. But I will kind of add, if you're looking to kind of try out Swift, which is one of the languages that Apple uses for developing iOS apps, since that is actually open source, there is a couple of places that you can go to at least try that out. I know IBM has a website that you can actually go into that actually has like a REPL inside the browser that you can actually
This is a website where you can just try out the code versus needing to install a text editor and sounds like Xcode and all of the iOS utilities.
Okay. But yeah, if you're going to make an app that you want to even just see just on your local phone or build it, or, you know, let's say that I build again a weather app and I want you to look at it, I'm going to have to be able to upload it to iTunes Connect or have, you know, something to actually sideload to you, which again has to be built on, mm-hmm. on a Mac.
So back to when you were making the jump from IT to testing and then testing to engineering, mm-hmm. what were you doing to prepare yourself to interview or apply to engineering roles from being a tester? I know you said you did some self-studying, but mm-hmm. how did you figure out how to do self-guided studying, if you know what I mean? I can clarify if you need to.
I mean, there's obviously the studying. I mean, you really just have to just sit down and absorb as much information as you can.
I mean, did you go to Barnes & Noble and buy an iOS for Dummies book?
Nah. Or? So, I mean, from when I went from IT to development, I actually did .NET stuff. And the only reason why I did .NET stuff originally was I was working as a QA person at a .NET shop or a Microsoft house, right?
Got it.
And, you know, as I was testing, what I started noticing is I started getting bored with manual testing.
Yeah.
And so I started kind of doing more and more white box testing. So I'd go up to developers and say, hey, yeah, I noticed there was this bug here. You kind of mind just showing me, like, what you did? And they'd be like, yeah, no problem. And so they'd be like, yeah, you see this thing? And I'm like, uh-huh. And most of the time at first, I didn't know what was going on. But I kind of used that to, I guess you could say, put like, a focus on what I would be studying or mm-hmm. what I would be kind of searching on Google or books that I was reading. Like, okay, this is this thing, so I'm going to study about this thing until I figure out, you know, what this person did to fix this
mm-hmm.
and potentially even find other things that maybe were broken on their end too. And I started kind of going towards that path towards the end too.
Right.
And so in that case, it was a combination of just studying and then, you know, befriending people and gaining knowledge from them and helping them out at the same time. And
what was the first interview you did for an engineering role? Were you nervous? Did you feel prepared or underprepared?
I will say, even to this day, I always feel underprepared. Like, I don't really think that's something a lot of engineers kind of get over. Even people that I know, like, you know, if they are looking for a job, I always say, are you ready this time? No.
Well, what for people who haven't applied or have been too scared to yet or haven't made it past a phone screen yet, What do contemporary entry-level iOS engineering interviews look like?
Okay.
What do you ask a junior engineer?
So I tend to be more of a practical applications guy. So there's definitely the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples that ask a lot of very textbooky, very
theoretical
stuff that, you know, I forgot in college already. But just more practical things, you know, like let me give you some examples of very complicated asynchronous programming and let's see what we could talk about. Let's see what we can do. There's been times where I've purposely written bad asynchronous code. And so it has someone come and say, you know, have you seen something like this? If not, you're like, hey, is there something that you notice is wrong with this? Or is there a better way that you would have done this? Is there a better framework that you could use to do some of this? Other things, have you done a specific feature that's relatively new, like rich push notifications that's new to iOS 10? You know, have you done something like that? Let me see your GitHub page. Let me kind of see what stuff that, you know, you just have to show off. I mean, it could be something as simple as like a, you know, driving salesman problem, you know. It just starts a conversation to kind of see, you know, what you could do the very first week that you start, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're coming in and you know all, you know how to use Magical Record, or you know how to use Core Data, or you know how to use Realm, the database framework,
mm-hmm.
like, those are things that I know that you already know based on the interview, so when you start, you can just jump right in there and know how to do them. I don't have to show you how to do them. You don't have to learn how mm-hmm. to use them either.
So I know the universe of tools and popular methodology for making iOS apps is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you personally, so I know a topic that you're very interested in and learning more about currently. Maybe you can share about the topic of reactive apps.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind sharing for the layperson what the reactive framework is and why there's this change in how people are writing iOS apps?
Okay, so I guess I'm going to need a little bit more clarification because there's this paradigm of reactive programming, and then there's, you know, reactive frameworks that might be different from other frameworks that are reactive. So do you mean just the general?
Which, like, is more interesting. Maybe more general.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, so the concept of reactive programming is just creating observables that string data, and then you're able to subscribe to them and figure out events that get given to you usually.
So let's say you're making an Uber app, mm-hmm. and there's the button for summoning a car.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe how it was before reactive and how reactive changes how the app works? Or if there's a better example, feel free to share it.
I think the easiest example is not necessarily something like Uber, because actually there's like a lot of things that have to deal with getting locations, and you know, you have this huge chain. But just to kind of add to that is, a lot of people like reactive programming because it does, in some instances, make a lot of things that depend on other things, like a stream of data or events, able to chain together. But I know one framework that I've noticed started to kind of pick up steam is RX Swift or RX Java, or pretty much the RX library, which is a cross-platform set of just guidelines of how you would do reactive in that sense. Are called RX stands for like reactive extensions. Mm-hmm. And so one way to kind of describe that is, let's say that you have a button, or let's say that you have a search text box, right? You enter in some text, you hit search, and then maybe it goes and returns you like a set of results. And so there's a lot of state that you have to do if you don't use reactive programming, where you have to say, okay, well, I have to make sure that when someone types something in, it's not empty. And then if it's empty, we don't want to do the search because we'll know we'll probably get a networking error. And then what happens if we get a networking error? And then, you know, how do we bind the data that comes back from, you know, the server to other elements in the UI? And so if you don't use anything that's reactive, you pretty much have to keep the state, like, of all these things. And so with, you know, an RX framework, pretty much what you can do is you can create what are called observables. So you can observe on changes to things, and then you could bind them to UI. And so that way you just take a model, you'd bind it to UI, and then magic pretty much happens.
Is RX and the set of reactive frameworks or libraries something that somebody in their first year of iOS development will likely encounter, or is this something that is a more advanced technique or just very cutting edge contemporary technique that you're more likely to encounter in like your third mm-hmm. through fifth years as an iOS engineer?
It's hard to say because I have such a small sample size.
Sure.
But I think we're starting to see it more. But just based on, again, my sample size, you probably won't see it for your first job at this point right now. But it's probably something you're going to want to have on your resume because it's starting to kind of spread like wildfire.
Got it. Yeah, this topic of frameworks for client-side software, like user interfaces and apps, is something I'm pretty ignorant about. So I was not even aware of this reactive approach to application design. So this is news to me.
Mm-hmm.
Are there parallels with browser-based applications or websites? Like, is there, I guess there's React.js,
yeah, there's,
the JavaScript
framework. There's RxJS, yeah.
How are RxJS and React.js different? Or are they related? Or?
That I'm not really sure. I'm not really a web guy, so I can't really tell you.
Okay. I know there's a bunch of different JavaScript frameworks. Sounds like they're similar to Rx that have the same design or end goal, which is that instead of managing the state of your page and your user interface, which can be a clusterfuck, you have two-way or three-way data binding where there's data that's on the server or in a database, and then there's data that's in your phone, and without needing to write any code, there's some callback or some less transparent process that syncs between what the what your phone is getting from the server and hearing on the network and what is displayed in the user interface, like where your car is, maybe if you're waiting for your car and your rideshare app or that kind of thing. So AngularJS, ReactJS, Vue.js are all, I think, the popular JavaScript frameworks for doing this. But do you mind sharing for people? I know there's a lot of hubbub about using JavaScript to write apps for whether it's iOS or Android. Do you mind sharing your opinion on that, how prevalent it is? Because I think some people see learning new programming languages as a real tackle, a real heavy investment of their time. For those who might be mulling over using Objective-C or Swift versus using JavaScript to write their iOS app, do you mind sharing how prevalent that is, how reliable it is in contrast to Objective-C, iOS,
Swift? I can't really give too great of an answer. I've never written an iOS app that wasn't using Objective-C or Swift at this point. There's obviously the promise of the, you know, write once and then, you know, being able to deploy on a multitude of devices. There's a React Native framework where you could build something that'll run on Android, iOS, the web as well. But honestly, I couldn't tell you. I've never written none.
Sure, sure.
But I will say, you know, going back to languages, a lot of people that I do know that use these types of frameworks, it's exactly why you say it. They just don't want to learn another language. And there's a time and place to learn new languages. Maybe you don't have time now. Maybe, you know, you need to get something out quickly and all you know is JS. But I just honestly, personally feel like that you learn so much learning other ways how to do stuff. And honestly, once you kind of get really good at one language, to trying to transition to another language doesn't really take that much time. The language, once you kind of start using it after a while, you start to kind of figure out like what it does well and what it doesn't work well for. And at the end of the day, you just kind of end up learning the frameworks. You end up learning the tool sets, but you'd have to do that anyways, you know, whether or not you're using JavaScript or not. So I just feel like that there's a lot that a lot of engineers I know are kind of missing by just staying siloed in one technology.
Do you mind sharing any predictions or forecasts you have for what developing iOS apps might look like 5 years out? I know that's a long time, and 5 years ago, developing iOS apps was probably pretty different, but any general observations or forecasts you mind going on the record about?
I will say we're probably going to start seeing more seamless integration of the web. Native apps.
For the layperson, what does that mean exactly?
So, you know, let's say that you have an app and then use the app and then you have a website and then, you know, it's usually a different context where, you know, you have an app that looks a certain way because mobile apps do some things better than the web, but then they do things that aren't as good on the web. Same thing with the web where the web does some stuff that's really good, but then maybe doesn't do as good as it should do as a native app. Because I really think that the web and mobile apps really serve two different kind of purposes. And so what I'm starting to kind of notice is just this ability to kind of bounce from one end to the other and then just having almost like this seamless transition of state. Like, let's say, you know, I pick up, you know, the Uber app and I request a ride or something, right? And I kind of want to look at, you know, some stats or something. Maybe the mobile app isn't the best client to kind of look at huge charts and graphs to show, you know, I don't know, maybe how fast the driver was driving. But, you know, if you were at home or something and you had your computer, it'd be kind of, you know, I'm starting to see things where, you know, you could bounce from your mobile app and then if you go and log into your computer, you're almost exactly where you're at, but then it might show more for that particular thing.
So one of the things that people might consider doing if they're new to programming or already know HTML, CSS, JavaScript is instead of trying to make a native installable iOS app is just make a web page that people can view in an optimized way for mobile. And then once you have that created, maybe come to an iOS engineer and ask them to port that to a native app. I mean, it's not as good for a variety of reasons, and there's a lot of features of iOS that you lose by not having your web page being a native mobile app. So do you mind listing some of the really big features that you lose by making a mobile optimized web page versus making an installable app? Like, I know some people can name these off the top of their heads, but some of the most basic ones, like push notifications, do you mind sharing like a list of the things that you get by making iOS apps that you wouldn't get if you're just making a web page?
Honestly, I couldn't really answer that question because I don't even really know like what the web could do these days.
Sure, it's changed a lot, yeah. And it's constantly changing. But as of 5 years ago, let's say, you could not get somebody's location data in real time in the same way that you can with a native mobile app. Push notifications you cannot do in a browser. What else is there? You get access to the camera, maybe, and video streaming. I know Instagram stories and Snapchat could not have been built as a web page that's optimized for phones. So there's a lot of really high value features that you have to learn Objective-C or Swift to be able to use or at least use easily. So I don't know. Any other topics we want to cover? Or?
I will say one of the most important things that I found out, and again, this is just my opinion, of course. One of the most important things to honestly learn early is time management. Okay. So going back to, how do you make the jump from whatever it is you're doing to software development? It's challenging, but you just got to manage your time really well and set like daily goals, set weekly goals, set monthly goals of just learning feature A, learning language B, learning technique C. And it doesn't have to be, you know, oh, I'm going to dedicate 3 hours every day this week because, you know, that's what it's going to take. And I always kind of equate programming to learning an instrument. Like, you can't sit down and practice 12 hours on the guitar and expect to be good afterwards. It's just not going to happen. Pretty much what you have to do is you just have to manage your time so that you do maybe 30 minutes a day for X amount of months. And I think with development, it's the same. You just really got to be consistent, and you really have to plan your time well to make sure that you always are learning constantly something.
I think one of the things you mentioned earlier that people should really take note of is that it really helps to get paid while you're doing this stuff, because one of the most inherent cool things about being an engineer is that a lot of your day is spent learning new skills. Mm-hmm. And so if you can get that entry-level position, not only will you get paid to learn this stuff, but you'll get a lot better quality feedback mm-hmm. about what is worth learning. I think that's something that a lot of people who are not employed to do software engineering, why they have any questions about what programming language to learn, mm-hmm. for example. Doesn't matter that much. Find a jobs listing that looks interesting. See what programming language they have on mm-hmm. there. So getting your foot in the door, even if it's not in an engineering role, like as a tester, you get face time with engineers mm-hmm. who can tell you what's valuable, how to do things, and can accelerate your learning a lot more than doing the self-guided 3 hours a week thing. So That's super. I think that's super sage advice mm-hmm. that you're giving here. So,
yeah. Another thing that could be helpful too is go to meetups. Sure. A lot of times in a lot of bigger cities, they always got a group of people that just have a space somewhere and then post it online and just say, hey, let's meet up and just go there, talk to people, figure out what people are doing, figure out how to befriend these people, because you never know, they could hook you up with a job later. They can tell you, a certain framework that they notice that they're using at their job that other people are learning. So you could kind of get this inside information as well.
For sure. Well, I'm sure we'll do this again. Thanks for joining us, Ryan. If you guys have any questions for Ryan, is there anywhere they can hit you up, like Twitter?
You can hit me up at Twitter at Five String Ryan.
Okay, Five String Ryan. And
number five, and then string.
If you guys like the content, feel free to subscribe on YouTube or check us out at our mailing list at theaccidentalengineer.com. Thanks, guys.